All right. I'm going to give you a sample this morning of what I am going to be doing for the young people's group at Grace in Bakersfield. I will be taking over the high school class there and getting them, next Sunday is our admission fest, by the way. You know that? We're going to have Eric Kayan. That'll be next Sunday. And then the following Sunday, the second Sunday in October, I'll begin teaching the young people's class. I'm following a book entitled Creative Questions for Christian Living. It's an old one. I had a terrible time finding enough copies. I could get one used one here and another used one there. It's an old book. It's way out there, you know. But it was one that I used back when. And anyway, this is a sample of that. It's got 128 lessons, actually, like that, like the one that you have in your hand. And, but it kind of surveys the entire Bible. It starts with Old Testament characters, and then some Psalms from the Psalms and Proverbs. And then the New Testament characters and the parables and the Sermon on the Mount and then epistles and so forth. So, you know, like I said, it covers all of the scriptures, and looking particularly at names, I guess you would say, or parables too at once. This is an example of a parable. All right, so open your Bibles to Luke 14. Luke 14, and the title, of course, which will become evident from the scriptures, the title of this particular lesson is number 46, is Making Excuses. Okay? Making Excuses. Luke 14, beginning with verse 15. Okay? I'll read the verses 15 through 24. And when one of them that sat at meat with him heard these things, he said unto him, Blessed is he that shall eat bread in the kingdom of God. Then he said unto him, A certain man made a great supper and bade many, sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were invited or bidden, Come, for all things are now ready. And they all with one consent began to make excuse. The first said to him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go see it. I pray you, have me excused. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. I must prove them or examine them. I pray you, have me excused. Another said, I've married a wife, and therefore I can't come. So that servant came and showed his lord these things. Then the master of the house, being angry, said to the servant, Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in hither the poor, and the maimed, and the halt, and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it is done, as thou hast commanded, and yet there's room. The Lord said unto the servant, Go out into the highways and hedges. Compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say to you, that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. Now, before we get to those questions on that handout, let me say a few things about this passage, and we have to begin by getting the setting or the context of this parable. All right. Now, the Lord had been invited to eat bread at the house of one of the chief Pharisees. Look at verse 1 of this chapter 14. Came to pass as he went to the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day that they watched him. Okay. Likely then, of course, this was a pretty elaborate feast. It was an expensive affair. And there were a lot present, mostly, you know, guests of importance, right? I think that becomes obvious. For instance, look at verse 7. He set forth a parable to those that were bidden when he marked how they chose out the places of honor, chief rooms, chief seats, important places, okay? And then verse 12, he said also to them that, then said he also to him that bade him, When you make a dinner or a supper, call not your friends or your brethren, or your kinsmen, nor your rich neighbors. lest they also invite you again and pay you back. Okay? So you can get the idea, of course, from those ideas, or from those verses. And this adds a lot more force to the admonition that you read in verse 12. And the master said to him that bade him, you know, invite your, don't call your friends or your brethren or whatever, you see, because they'll, you know, you'll expect to be paid back, and of course they'll try to do that. Well, anyway, the Lord's words in verse 14, and that's where we began, we began at verse 15. But the Lord's words in verse 14 called for were said by one who was present, and it's an overly pious proclamation, quite pretentious. He says, "Blessed is he that shall eat bread in the kingdom of heaven." Well, you know, you can read between the lines of that statement, because mostly the Jews, the higher class Jews, believed that the resurrection of the just, and that was going to be a big public affair, was going to be an open setting up of the kingdom of God, and that would be ushered in by a great feast, of which, of course, all of them would be present, you know, expected to be members and partakers. And so, you know, this guy who utters this phrase does it with pretty easy assurance that certainly, you know, he's going to be among them, one of the privileged few, you know, or the privileged number. After all, he's a Pharisee. And the Pharisees were the best. They were members of an elect nation. He had been invited to that great, figured he had been invited to the great feast of God, and never considered, never entered his heart, and I think he's quite typical of all the Pharisees, never considered whether they had really truly accepted, you know, the call from God. Or that, you know, he refused to enter into the higher spiritual life. That was really it was not something concerned him, and concerned the Pharisees as a class as well. So that's the setting, and it's to him and to others like him then that this parable is spoken. All right, the parable, of course, of the excuses. So let's start. We've already discussed verse 15, verse 16. Then said he unto him, "A certain man made a great supper and bade many, invited a host." And who were they? Well, I think you already know from the context. They were the priests, the elders, the scribes, the Pharisees. The higher class of Jews, as the latter part of this parable indicates. They seem to consider themselves to be the first ones, you know, that had indeed followed after righteousness. But it was a righteousness of their own making. 17. And he sent his servant at supper time to say them to them that were bidden, "Come, for all things are now ready." You have to understand that there's a usual custom here that was followed. And that is that there's kind of like a double invitation. There's the first invitation, of course, to those who are invited. But then later, then the host, of course, thinking now, you know, he's got a he has. I suppose it's almost like what RSVP or something like that. And he figures, well, now I know who's coming. And so now he goes and he prepares the meal. He gets everything ready. And then he sends out another invitation. Okay, so the feast, everything is ready now, so you can come. All right? to those that had already been bidden. That was the custom. I'd already accepted the invitation. But there's a surprising development here, isn't there? Because all of those who had indicated they were coming, what happens? They don't. They don't show up. They show contempt for this invitation, which they had accepted, or at least indicated. Their contempt is shown by all the excuses. By all the excuses for not showing up, for not coming. All things are now ready. And of course, the fullness of time. And again, the idea, of course, here is a spiritual meaning behind this parable. And that is that the kingdom of heaven is being set up. And is set up. The Jews, of course, are the first to receive the call. But also then Gentiles, as this parable will indicate. Now, by servant, you know, the servant that's doing this, by servant is quite likely meant the preachers, evangelists, apostles, and so forth. You know, the message of salvation now has gone forth. Verse 18. And they all with one consent begin to make excuse. The first says to him, I have bought a piece of ground. I got to go and see it, examine it. So I need to be excused. So now, first of all, as we go through these excuses for not showing up at the banquet, as we look at those, we should see that it is not... Those things that concern them are not necessarily sinful in themselves, are they? No. But of course, it's how they consider them or how they think of them and where they place their importance, and we will see that. Well, anyway, this first one, he is elated with his possessions, right? With his field. And of course, what it's referring to, of course, is spiritually, is the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, in wanting to see his possessions. Again, let me say that none of these occupations were sinful themselves, but became sinful because, you know, they took that importance. Verse 19. Another said, "I have bought 5 yoke of oxen." I got to go and examine them, prove them, see how they work. Have me excused. Here again, you know, the focus is put on the care of his earthly existence. Of his occupation, and so, and how he can improve. Again, not necessarily wrong, but it takes over. You see, has to try out these oxen, and maybe it is too before the purchase of them is finalized. You know, he wants a good deal. He wants oxen that are going to work. Okay. So he's concerned with business. Number 20, and another said, "I've married a wife. I can't come." What do we think of this? Well, again, his own pleasures take over, huh? In fact, he doesn't even ask here to be excused. He just says what? I can't come. Yeah, well, you know, your honeymoon. He's on a honeymoon. He can't be, you know, going to church. Yeah.
Wasn't there something in the Old Testament about a marriage? You wouldn't have to walk the war if you were married.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a years right. Exactly, where, you know, you were excused from military service and so forth. So he was free, you know. But You know, I don't know if that was something that was in his mind, or if that was something that, you know, he was thinking about, that therefore he thought that excused him. I it's possible. So, he has plans of his own, and so he's not going to come. Look at verse 26 in this chapter. If any man come to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife, his children, his brothers, his sisters, and his own life also, he can't be his disciple. Cannot be my disciple. That was not of particular concern to this guy, was it? Or at least it wasn't on his mind. So, verse 21. So that servant came now, who was doing the inviting and so forth. The servant came and showed his Lord these things. And then the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, go out quickly into the streets, the lanes of the city, and bring in hither the poor, the maimed, the halt, the blind, and so forth. He reports to his master, this servant, and says that all of them have excused themselves. It's kind of reminiscent of what we see in the last part of verse 21, 21c, yet there are, go out of the highways, the hedges, compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. The thing of it is, the master is not satisfied, with empty seats, there's an interesting passage that kind of serves as a commentary here. If you turn back to or turn ahead to John chapter 7. John 7, and read verses 45 through 48. Ryan, you got that? John 7, 45 to 48.
Then came the officers of the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said unto them, why have you not brought him? The officers answered, never man spake like this one. And answered them, the Pharisees, are ye also deceived? Have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him? But this people who knoweth not the law are cursed. Nicodemus saith unto them, he that came to Jesus by night, being one of them, doth our law judge any man before it hear him and know what he doeth? They answered and said unto him, art thou also of Galilee? Search and look, for out of Galilee ariseth no prophet. And every man who
Alright, there you see again some of the attitudes of the Pharisees, right? In fact, it says, have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on Jesus? And it's a rhetorical question, and of course the answer is, yeah, none of them did. So they rejected him. And certainly that, of course, is also what this parable is teaching. They totally reject the gospel, but that's not going to be the way that it ends up, this banquet with a whole bunch of empty seats or nobody there, because now we see that the invitation goes out, of course, to the poor, the maimed, the halt, and the blind, in verse. Verse 23, the Lord says unto the servant, go out in the highways, hedges, compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. Now, up to this point, up to verse 22, yet there is room. Up to this point, the parable has been historical, or historic, I should say. But now, it becomes prophetic. Because far more will sit down at the feast than a remnant of Jewish people, huh? Because now the invitation goes out worldwide, doesn't it? It goes out to the Gentiles. And that's what is meant by, you know, the poor, the maimed, the halt, and the blind. And notice too, what else has to happen? And we'll see more of this in the message this morning, in the sermon this morning. What else has to happen to get people to come to this banquet? Huh? Yeah, it has to be. But what has to happen to the people? Yes, and what is it? They have to be compelled. They have to be compelled to come to this banquet. And again, isn't that also what is true of every believer? And like I say, we'll see some more of that. The power of God's grace is the title of the message this morning. And we will see how indeed that is necessary. The gospel has to certainly be proclaimed with vigor, with authority, with power. But again, man has to be compelled. John 6:44 is part of the text for this morning. Quickly, John 6:44. Do you have it, Larry? John 6:44. Okay, and we'll get into a little bit of the meaning of that draw, and what that's all about, what that means, and so forth. But here, of course, we see verse 23, compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. Quote here from Luther: men are compelled when the law is preached, terrifying their conscience and driving them to Christ as their only refuge, unquote. And of course, there too, that has the idea of compulsion, doesn't it? Yeah, compulsion. Because the banquet house will be full. God's elective purposes aren't going to fail. You know, and that's what we see here, that my house may be filled. And of course, then it ends with, for I say to you that none of those which were bidden, and all those that came up with excuses, shall taste of my supper. There's no more admission when it's too late. So just a couple of passages there. Proverbs 1:27-28. Proverbs 1:27-28.
When your terror comes like a storm, and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me.
Yeah, there comes a time when God wipes the dust off his feet, so to speak, doesn't he? And it's too late. It's too late. No more admission when it's too late. And I think that's what this parable is setting forth. You know, the excuses are not going to work. They're just not going to work. And it's nothing less than internal exclusion and everlasting destruction. There's a kind of a parallel passage by Paul in 1 Corinthians 1. You want to turn to 1 Corinthians 1?1 Corinthians 1:26-29. Let's see. Bobby?
For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. God God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his brethren.
All right. That's for you. Isn't that the point of this parable as well? Yeah, I think so. You know? No flesh should glory in his presence. Isn't that what those Pharisees were doing all the time? You know? Thinking they were righteous and that they were deserving of salvation. And yet, of course, they are turned away. Well, anyway, any comments? That is briefly then a look at the passage itself before we move now to the questions. All right, number one. The men in the parable present excuses for not coming to the feast. Are people today different than they were? No. That is still the sinful nature, isn't it? Yeah, Bobby.
Ecclesiastes, that's what you was, is, and that's what you will be, as always been.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, there's nothing new under the sun. That's very much the point. And we see those excuses still being used today, used excessively, in fact, I'm afraid. So, number two, Adam blamed his wife for his sin. You remember that? He said, that woman you gave me, she's the one that, you know, put that fruit up to my mouth and I ate it. Huh? Blamed his wife for his sin. Married people often blame their mates for their problems. You think that's true? Do married people often blame their mates for their problems? I trust that's not true of us. Okay. But I mean, generally speaking, is that true? I mean, have things changed since Adam and Eve? No. No. Bobby.
Since I'm the single one of the crowd, I think I might be best answer. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. It's certainly not a realistic approach to cast blame. I know that's... why does that happen? No. It's because people don't want to admit their own faults. So, in fact, aren't we supposed to confess our faults one to another? Yeah. Don't I always do that, dear? But it's just more of the same, more of excuse making. Yeah, Bobby.
Yeah, this analysis right here is reasoning. He said, when I start to look at what's wrong in the world, he said, the first thing I realize, it's me. I'm what's wrong in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm the chief boss.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly the point. You know, we should always begin with, looking within. Yeah. Mark.
Yeah, I wonder, too, the reluctance to confess because of the response of the other side. And the only reason I say that, I'm not talking about marriage, I'm talking about just, like, working with kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have that up on my wall saying, you know, a good way to deal with your problems is the wrong way.
Yeah.
One is blaming other people.
Yeah.
And a good way to say, yeah, I get it. And I really work with them on that and say, you know, if you say, I get it, it's done, it's over, the problem's gone, it's done. You owned up to it.
Yeah.
And it's funny, they'll start responding to that. Yeah, I did it. Yeah, I did it. And then, okay, see, the problem's gone. It's
yeah.
Finished. That's all I was looking for.
Yeah, of course, then it can't stop at that either, though, can it? Yeah, I did it. But then what are you going to do about it? You know, are you going to stop that? Are you sorry for that? So, anyway, good point. Three. Today, many people blame heredity or environment for their problems and troubles that they have. You think that's true? Oh boy, is it ever, huh? Yeah. So I don't think there's any disagreement with that statement. What do you think of this? In fact, we see a lot of that today. And this is also getting into number four. Psychiatrists often get their patients to talk about their parents and their early life. Do they do this to find an excuse for the illnesses of their patients, so forth? And of course, that gets back to that heredity and environment type of thing. Is that where the problem is? In heredity and environment? Yeah, Bobby.
I was listening by, I guess, Darren Hernandez. They're saying that he had CTE.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think courts extend leniency to a person committing a crime because of his early background? Yeah. A lot of times they will allow that as an excuse. Is that an excuse? Can you blame? You know, some children have not very good home life. So, but you know, it's interesting. Deuteronomy 24:16. Deuteronomy 24:16. Anybody? Have it? Scott, got it?
Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin.
Kind of puts it in perspective, doesn't it? You're not going to get by with blaming someone else for what you did, for the sin that you committed. And the same thing is repeated in 2 Chronicles 25:4. We don't have to go to that now, but it's exactly the same thing. But you know, God responds according to the acts of each individual. He doesn't blame the parents for the sins of their children. Not at all. Look at Jeremiah 31:30. I mean, there's a number of verses, but Jeremiah 31:30. Judy, you have it? Jeremiah 31:30. All right, go ahead.
But everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man who eats the sour grapes, his teeth shall be set on edge.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times that was the excuse. Well, you know, it's because the parents have eaten sour grapes or something or other. And that was the way to get around, you know, to make an excuse for some people's actions. So, but God responds that, you know, He's going to punish everyone according to their own acts. And it's not going to work to lay the blame on you know, parents or whoever. So now, don't misunderstand this, you know, these verses. And by the way, when you get home today, look at Ezekiel 18 once. In fact, it's pretty much that whole chapter that deals with this issue of what we're talking about, you know, and that each one is going to bear his own iniquity. You're not going to get by with trying to blame another generation or parents or whatever. The whole chapter, you know, drives that point home. Ezekiel 18. Okay. Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, the second commandment is this, I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me.
Yeah.
How does that fit into that?
Well, I think that, you know, the children learn, don't they? The children learn from their parents. And, you know, a lot of times what their parents have done and what how their parents acted and the example the parents set forth, that's what is going to also be true of the children. But they're still going to have to bear their own iniquity. That doesn't that doesn't cancel that out. And another thing too, I think we have to understand is that this parable, when Jesus talks to about this or gives this parable, he is not denying the fact of original sin or denying the doctrine of original sin. But original sin is not an excuse either. An original sin explains, why we sin and why we do what we do, but it doesn't excuse it. Yeah.
I think sexual predators are a good example of that, where oftentimes they were abused as children by their parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Not sexually. And so you see that next generation follow in the footsteps of their father, but at the same time, you're right. They know right from wrong because you see it because they try to cover up what they did.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have both. The exacerbating of how they destroy their children, but at the same time their children knew it was wrong.
Yeah. But I think that's the idea of visiting the sins of the fathers upon the children, you see. They are what they see and what they've learned and what they've been taught. And so forth, and certainly, fathers are going to be held in, are going to be brought to account for that, very much so. But that does not mean that the children are not going to be punished for what they did and their sin, and that the verses that we looked at make that abundantly clear. Yeah. No. Yeah, yeah. Born and conceived in sin. And, we have a heart that's prone by nature. We're prone by nature to hate God and our neighbor. Yeah.
You used to say that the sins, the parents walking, the children running.
Yeah. And that does often become the case. Yeah. 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 Because as the generations. As the generations come and go, we see that a lot of times they become more sinful, exceedingly sinful. Yeah. But modern psychiatry and modern psychology don't concern themselves much with sin, do they? No. They've got to find another solution. And now, the whole thing, all these mental disorders and so forth, all of that is a lot of times blamed on a mix-up of chromosomes or something? Or, they try to find a medical answer to sin or a psychiatric answer, and there isn't, Now, does that mean that all psychology and psychiatry are worthless? I'm not saying that, but a lot of it is. So, because when they're dealing with people, and you got people that come in and they're mentally off or depressed, emotionally down, and so forth. What is that first and foremost an indication of? And a lot of times, I'm accused of being a little bit harsh this, but first and foremost, what does it indicate? Huh? Yeah, and there's a weakness there, isn't there? A spiritual weakness. A lack of, a weakness of faith. And perhaps no faith at all as well. But, a lot of times people will not accept that. They will not believe that because, they think that there's got to be a cure for that. There's got to be a cure. The psychiatrist can cure it or maybe there's even some medication that'll cure it. Medication won't cure sin. to a lot of people, you know, that's what they depend on, and so forth. But it's more excuses. They find an excuse for the illnesses of their patients, verse 4 there. You know, if you read Romans 5, maybe make a note of that. Turn to Romans 5 real quickly. It's pretty plain about sin. Romans 5, look at about verse 12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Of course, we know that that's compared also to the by one man salvation came, the gift of grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. And not as it was by one that sinned, so is the gift, for the judgment was by one to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses unto justification. For if by one man's offense death reigned by one, much more shall they which receive abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness shall reign in life by one, that is Jesus Christ. Therefore, as by the offense of one judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by righteousness of one, the righteousness of one, the free gift, came upon all men unto justification. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. Verse 19. That cause is the root cause of a lot of problems, that, you know, right there. And that's pretty much dismissed. You know? Dismissed. Number 5. Many people use the excuse, I'm too busy. What do you think of that?
That's my favorite.
Is that your favorite?
Yeah.
A busyness, is this just a busyness complex? You think that people can become overwhelmed by their work? Yeah, they can. They can. But again, you got to be careful that's, you know, you don't use that as an excuse to sin. Yeah.
Ecclesiastes says, do not be over righteous about much, why destroy yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. A good reference. Yeah.
That's an admonition to employers too.
Yeah.
Don't overwork
them, right? They have a responsibility as well. So, 6. Some people will say that they broke down emotionally or mentally because they're overworked. I think we've already maybe alluded to that or discussed it some. Is this true? Broke down emotionally or mentally because they overworked. What do you think that, you know, again, a lot of people work themselves into a frenzy or you know, but fail to you know, admit that, look, their faith also is suffered as a result, you see? And so they make excuses. You know, they certainly, maybe they're emotionally or mentally disturbed, but, you know, there's a solution for that, not just an excuse of too much work. 7. When people blame the devil for the temptations that come to them, are they given an explanation or making an excuse? Yeah, that was pretty popular for a while, right? They say, well, the devil made me do it. Yeah. Now, maybe there may be some truth to that, but is that a good excuse? No. No. Yeah, Mark.
Do you make a distinction between the temptation and giving in to temptation, right? You can be tempted.
Yeah.
You just resist
it. But what does it say? What does the song say? Yield not to the temptation. No, in this world we will have trials, we will have temptations. But you know, I think that's the point of the Lord's Prayer too. And it says, "Lead us not into the temptation." That you know, we commit the sin. Now, it doesn't mean that, look, there's not going to be temptations. There are temptations all around us, you know. But don't let us fall into them, so that we commit the sin. Yeah. Oh yeah, Mark.
Yeah, you know, Larry had brought this up a while back, and I think I said it, and I know he heard somebody else say it. He said, "The devil told me." Like, you remember that? And then he kind of said, "Wait a minute, you know, like the devil's getting in your mind." I don't know if you.
Yeah.
It was a Christian who was saying that.
Yeah.
The devil somehow told me. Like, hold on. If you're a Christian, the temple of the Holy Spirit, Satan can't invade your mind and speak to you.
Yeah. Well, it's the idea of casting blame again, right? Making an excuse, rather than wanting to own up to what's the real problem. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's so much to it, a truism behind that. Isn't that what Scroll points out about Luther and how
the when he threw the inkwell at the devil, so forth?
There is a sense to it, though.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't want to deny the devil, do you? We can't do that, because what do we read? That he goes around as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. I mean, we have to understand that. So, yeah, sometimes he can transform himself as well. Yeah, it does. But again, we simply have to understand, you know, that by nature we are sinful, you know, born and conceived in sin, but that there is a way that we can overcome, and that is through the grace of God, you know, and the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Yeah, Mark.
I think the temptations, I guess, just for clarification. Can the devil put thoughts in your mind? I think that was the question. You know, like, we understand temptations can come from the outside. You have these foul thoughts in your head.
Yeah.
Did you ever say the devil put that there, or is that's just your flesh?
Well, that's the flesh. You know, that the flesh, our sinful nature, that we have got to. I mean, it's a fight. It's a fight of faith. It's a constant. It's a constant battle where we've got to fight against that sin and the devil in this life and hereafter to reign with the Lord Christ in eternity. But no, we are engaged in a fight, in a battle, and you know, the temptations that come to us, surely they're inspired by the devil. I mean, he's the source of sin, you know. Yeah.
We see that with Judas Iscariot. Satan already had put an end to him to see if he wanted to betray
him. Yeah.
He was an unbeliever, right?
But I mean, you know, the unbelievers is got to fight the good fight of faith, and that means that you have to resist temptation. What do we also, was it James, resist the what? Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Yeah. So again, you know, you can't, you know, you can say, well, the devil made me do it, but that doesn't excuse it, does it? Because you did it, and you will be held accountable. Yeah.
Didn't work in the garden.
No, didn't. That's true, very much. So they're making excuses when they blame the devil for the temptations. Why do people go to so much trouble to make excuses? Why don't they admit the truth and face up to it? Yeah. You know, when it says, why do people go to so much trouble to make excuses? You know, it's because they are ruled. I think what this question has in mind is basically those who are not born again, you know. And so, yeah, they're going to constantly look for an excuse for that will excuse them, or an explanation for what they do wrong. They don't want to admit the truth and face up to it. But again, too, they you know, have got to be brought to that place. They got to be compelled. So, why should we help our children get over this matter of making excuses? Some are very convincing in their excuses. How can you tell whether they are real? How do we help our children get over the matter of making excuses? Oh, yeah, our time is up. I'm sorry. There's one more. One of the defense reactions that is described by psychologists called rationalization. This means that a person finds a reasonable explanation for his actions, even though it's not always the whole truth. Why do people use such means? Should it be considered lying, or is it just part of human weakness? Well, again, you know, we have got to understand what we are by nature, and that we are prone by nature to hate God and our neighbor. What is the answer? I wish that more people would understand, and maybe we've got to grow in our understanding of that too. You know what's going to solve a host of problems? Number two of the catechism. What is number two of the catechism? What are the three things that we ought to know in order to live life? First, know the greatness of your sin and misery. Know how you are redeemed from that sin and misery. And then know how you are to live a life of thankfulness. You see, and if you follow those, if we teach that to our kids, and that becomes ingrained in them from you know, young on, that's going to help solve or meet a lot of temptations and problems. So, I'll just leave you with that. Was a lot of thought and put into the writing of the catechism, and I think that, you know, that would also help to deal with a host of problems where there's all kinds of excuses. Well, I'm sorry. Anyway, that's an example of example of what is going to happen in the youth group. We're going to have to learn how to cut it down to the right amount of time.